So, these two monads were walking down the street. And one monad looks at the other and says, "Hey, can you tell me what type of monad you are?" And the other says, "Maybe." Hey, howdy-ho, this is Daniel Markham here for another Nerd Roundup. If you don't know what Nerd Roundup is, you're quite fortunate because you haven't missed a damn thing in your life except for hanging out with some nerds and laughing and telling jokes. What we do is every week we come here and look at the week's news and tech. The idea is that teams that relax and joke around can do really, really cool things. And the only way I really know to show you how to relax and joke around is just to do it. So that's what we do. Every week we get together and just shoot the shit. And this week I have Eric, I have Greg, and John. Hey, guys.
Hey, you are.
Hey, guys.
Hello there.
You can't see me, but I'm waving.
Yeah, Greg is stuck in a box for some reason this week. He's in the penalty box, maybe it's a box. So, yeah, you're on a limited bandwidth, so you're going to try to stay off the video as much as possible, right?
Yep.
And, Eric, since this is your first time, would you like to tell us, like, a little bit about what you do?
See, you know me long enough to know that I'm never succinct in anything.
So you're in good company here, because we don't go,
I'll start at the beginning. I'm at year number 26 of professional software development. Started in the mid-80s on a TRS-80 color computer to jump a bunch to the future, a bunch of different jobs in embedded and stuff in Mac OS 10 and desktop development to mobile development starting in 2008. And since 2008, practically everything I've done has been iOS, Android, mobile dev. Just for the last year, I took over development for a local early stage startup, which has caused me to also have to learn some PHP to tinker with the back end code.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's been not so bad. Kind of fun, actually. Come to enjoy it.
So, John, what have you been up to this week?
Oh, just getting back from Morocco. And work-wise, I did a couple of sessions with some teams on the kind of the core concepts that wrap themselves around story mapping and behavior-driven development and just breaking things down into nice, discernible chunks and helping folks learn. One of the hard things to do is to abstract away a lot of the details, right? I mean, it's not uncommon to have 30 acceptance criteria, and some people might plow through them rather deliberately, and I might take a machete and slash and you know, help turn those into a better order of value-driven and things like that. So that's kind of what I've been doing.
Pretty cool. Greg, what you been up to?
Oh, mostly dealing with crazy all around me. But aside from that, I had some fun this week actually playing with some stuff in Event Store.
Ooh.
So I've been trying out different ways of looking at our indexing.
Okay.
So right now what we do is basically we write down files, and then the files get merged as they get bigger, and they're immutable.
Okay.
But what if we were to try something like a B-plus tree instead?
Ah, yes. Yeah. That's the logical place to go.
And then once you start getting into B-plus trees, then, well, how do you want to pad those? How do you want to... And there's a lot of questions you start getting into.
How are you going
to
balance them?
Associated with it.
Bunch of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, that's...
What amuses me about the world of software development is that I can, especially being a mobile guy, that I can sit in a group of other programmers and not have a clue of what they're talking about because the entire realm of what they're discussing is so far removed from what I do.
You know, Eric, I get the feeling, I grew up, my dad was a diesel mechanic, and so he would come home and he would describe going through the lifters, and I got to the point I could sort of nod, and I understood the words, but I had no idea what he's talking about.
Yeah, my thought when Greg was waxing about, I was going to say B-splines, but that's not what it was, I'm an engineer. I'm glad somebody gives a shit about that low-level crap and designs a better doubly linked list. I just want to use and get something real done.
Greg's program is finally growing up. So this week I did something a little cool. If you guys will indulge me for about 20 seconds, you're not very long. I learned that if you're writing a script in Ubuntu or any sort of Linux that has .NET on it, you can actually write the dang script in F sharp. And where you do your shebang up here at the top, instead of putting in Bash, you just put in .NET FSI. And then, golly fuck, if you're just not in F sharp there. And I, what I did was I took some time to arg 1, 2, and 3 here. How would I pull out args? Then I took some time to write a function to get the incoming string so I could pipe stuff in, because I wanted to know that. And that got kind of gnarly. That was about 50 lines. But it wasn't too bad. I could throw that in a function and never look at it again. And the incoming stuff is basically, it's standard, allocate a buffer, read stuff in. If you're done, you're done. If not, allocate another buffer and append it and read more in. That's pretty low-level stuff, actually. But it was a hoot. I had fun.
So, you know, Daniel, it's been a while since you know, we talked tech stuff. Are you still on the functional programming kick? Is that still a thing for you?
I've tried to go to support groups. I've been to a couple. I just can't do it. I love me some OO programming, but what I love about it, it happens to do with analysis right now. So I really love thinking about all this stuff I learned in OO in terms of getting the language down.
So, right. Daniel, as you're dealing with those buffers, if you go look inside of the event store, source space, there's something in there called Buffer Manager, which you very likely want to pull out.
It was interesting. I did a, you know, get stuff coming in. And, of course, Bash has multiple channels and multiple streams going in, so I just get standard in. And then, of course, well, do you want to do name pipes or not? And so then I went, Microsoft had their own OO library to do, I think it's system.io.pipes. And it's this whole clusterfuck of events and tasking and all this. And it's nothing that's wrong with it. It's just I don't need to buy like the 747 to go, you know, crop dust the field. So I just stuck with that and left. I want to try to keep it simple, Greg. Simple.
Well, but I'm only talking about for dealing with the memory allocations. So basically what Buffer Manager does is it makes big buffers that sit up on the large object heap and then manages them, giving them out of smaller buffers.
God, that's, wow, yeah, that is, golly fuck, that's just way, way, and they got little pieces of grass on it. I just wanted to see if I could stream stuff in.
Well, no, basically what it does is it keeps them off of the Gen 1 and Gen 2 heaps.
And we used to do much the summer thing in C. I mean, manage your own buffers, manage your own memory store. That's standard practice for C. Okay, so the first link is, this is one I saw several times. I wanted to flag it. I lost it. And then somebody posted it again. This is do nothing scripting. And the guy's idea, which is kind of stupid and brilliant at the same time, is that when you want to start automating something, don't code it all at once. Instead, just make a script that doesn't do anything. And here he's got a script that just does the steps he would do manually. All it does is print stuff out. And then he slowly goes in and replaces those functions with actual stuff. It's genius. It's pretty cool.
I actually liked it a lot. It always amuses me because I've seen it written and talked about many times that programmers automate and script things because they're lazy. They don't want to have to do the work of manually doing these tasks over and over and over again. And so then it makes me question, am I lazy or ultra lazy because I'm too lazy to write the script to automate things? So where does that put me? And I don't know.
I think a big part of this as well is actually observed in other areas. Where, for instance, we will build a UI before we build any of the logic behind the UI.
Yes. And we put
it in front of users, and we let them use it before we've built anything off behind it.
And we talked last week about the reverse of that, where you actually write the code in the command line and then go do the UI later.
Right.
Both good.
I don't use the do the UI first because it forces me, you know, the UI is the cool stuff that, ooh, I get to see something on screen and you get happy and then you do the boring stuff later. And I feel like over the years I've learned if I force myself to do the cool on-screen stuff last, it will give me motivation to get the other not as cool stuff done sooner.
There might be a different way of phrasing that. A better way of phrasing that might be, we want to separate what people are seeing from what's actually happening behind it so that they can work independently of each other.
Separation of concerns. Well, that sounds like a good idea, Greg. We should run with that.
Now, if only just, someone had thought about this.
No, we just need a 7-tier architecture to put that make that happen. We'd be fine.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd just go with show some visible value through whatever stack is necessary. Like doing all the back end or doing all the UI is worthless if it's not what you're delivering.
Yeah, I think there's two things that you can, like blue sky, what you guys would like to do. You can do that with the wireframes or just a flip chart. And then there's what problem are you trying to solve? Let's engage with that problem. And I wouldn't mix them up too much because then you get like a mess on both sides.
Although, John, coming back to your comment, I am probably an outlier for it. Our product is literally a database.
Oh, it's often the ability like your actual product. Okay.
Yeah.
But still, your product has features, right? And you know, working on my basic point is, if we're talking about delivery, it's, you know, even if you're delivering, you know, the ability to do crazy ass, you know, queries, some nifty something or other indexing. The point is still to not lose sight of delivering something,
right?
Not just working on parts of the, you know, it's the classic. Don't just work on all the bricks if I'm asking for a house, and don't just, you know, go out and grow a tree farm. Right? I mean, so. It doesn't really, to me, it doesn't matter if there's a UI or it. You still have some value that you're trying to deliver. And my point is merely, don't lose sight of that.
There should be some stress involved. And I don't mean like difficult. You shouldn't like have to eat a bunch of antacids. But whatever the person wants should cause you to do things you wouldn't normally do. Like maybe you have to do more screen stuff, maybe do more back end. Because then you know you're actually engaging them with their problem instead of just telling them how you're going to do stuff.
One thing I have found very, very weird, having worked on a database for a decade now, is that the features that we put in inside of our main code base, 90% or more is actually underlying code of the database.
Yeah.
But the things that are the most popular are the little bits of JavaScript that we put on top of it, where we let you see some cool shit about it.
I feel this pain. Oh, yeah. This next story is Roadkill of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And I like this a lot. I think Eric said he liked it before we started. This is about automated driving. And it brings up the case of this poor lady that got, or poor man that got ran over by a Waymo car. I think one of the key takeaways I had was it's not that we're coding. Not necessarily that we're coding machines that could be dangerous. It's that we don't know why they're doing what they're doing. And without really knowing that, there's no way for us to make a judgment or whether they're dangerous or not. It's just sort of a magic box we're making. What did you get out of this, Eric?
An impossible to debug workflow. A decision tree that in the apps I develop, I can step through and figure out why did this happen. And it might take me a while, and I might have to do some tweaking to figure it out, but I can figure out why this happened. Everything we're talking about here is things are going to happen that we cannot explain how we got there. The artificial intelligence is not designed to say, let me give you the millions of inputs that I factored in to making this decision.
And you know, there's this replay
How
problem.
How do you debug a system?
Yeah, there's a replay problem. Even if you somehow make some little magic tweak to fix it, you could run the same data through and actually get a different answer. I mean, when you don't know why you're getting the answer you're getting, it's unclear exactly what you need to change.
I guess I'm going to run on an assumption that what you just said I would call a hypothesis. I would hope that it is repeatable so that, you know, when I'm in when I'm in, let's say, beta testing or alpha testing mode, I'm logging the crap out of all inputs so that I could actually rerun a scenario.
Doesn't work that way here, John. See, you've got maybe a grid of 40, 50 inputs, and then you've got millions of those inputs coming in every second, and the computer's going through each of those 40 or 50 and making associations, and then it's figuring out which strings of associations are actually most likely to indicate some action. And that's just too complex for you to actually figure out. And unless you reload the entire system, it's non-replayable. It's going to be different every time.
Well, some of them are actually non-replayable at all, because we also use randomization in terms of how we're going to be adjusting things.
Yep.
As an example, if I have a neural network, it's very common for me to, when I'm adjusting strengths based on something that's been observed and was correct, that I do it with randomization associated with it.
Well,
the other thing that I got to...
Yeah, I'm sorry, Eric. I'm just saying, in the thought bubble above my head about the system, if I'm in charge, I can collect all of the inputs, and I know the state of the system at any point in time. And I would build potentially, I've been thinking about this for 5 seconds, so it's not that deep. But in other systems similar to that, I've done things like that to be able to actually take the messaging that was coming into the system to be able to replay it at the state at which the system got it to be able to replicate something.
But the system,
I'm not saying...
Yeah, I'm just saying the system doesn't respond to the messaging in the way...
And John, this is starting to sound a lot like a...
I'm not talking about a learning system and what is it going to do an hour from now with those same inputs. I'm talking about... I should be able to define the system state. And at a certain point in time, sure, it might be learning stuff, but by the time it hit that person, I should have the log of all the crap that went into it to either show what it did. Because if not...
Well, it's a state machine. You could technically pull a petabyte or two off or whatever and start digging through all that
stuff. Right, I'm not saying it's simple. I'm just saying in my little reptile brain, It is a solvable problem because it's not a human. It's not a brain. It's a physical thing we built. It's not random acts of computing.
It's not, but it's random probabilistic acts of computing based on prior Bayesian or frequency stuff, right? So it is random.
I'm hoping that given the same state and the same inputs, it would always react the same way.
If you did that,
if not, then that's a weird system.
Yeah, it is. It is a system built not to be able to be debugged, as far as I can tell.
Well, pretty much any backwards, any backwards feeding neural network is going to reach that.
If this self-driving car did something based on the last 60 seconds, but the state that it was in 60 seconds ago has built over time from things it learned over the last year, we could replay the entire last year's worth of inputs to get it to the state where it was. It caused it to make the decision in 60 seconds, but are we going to go back the whole year to day zero of the system?
No, we probably can't, because when you're doing backwards feed networks like that, there's normally randomization involved as well.
Trace back. Unless you log every connection, you could. Yeah, you could.
Yeah,
if you logged every little activity it took, and then you'd end up with something like two orders of magnitude bigger than maybe exabyte size.
Well, and then one of the things you typically do in engineering like that is when I want to test a suspension and simulate driving, I don't do all the boring bits, right? I mean, you can compress the actual, you can go drive a road and bumpy things like that. You can compress elements of the core system probably so that you don't have to replay a whole year. Who knows? But
the gimmick, John, the gimmick they do here is that they track more variables than you can keep in your head at one time. And that's just at one split second in time. That's not the linkage between the variables and all the tracking. And so you could technically, if there's a state machine and somehow you logged everything and did a journal, you might be able to do something there, but you wouldn't be able to understand it. It's beyond our reasoning ability. It would be finite. You're right. It would be a Turing machine, but you wouldn't be able to grasp it.
Maybe not, but I would break it down into components, like things that can recognize a human, things that can recognize a car, right? I mean, anyway.
See, there you go. Yeah, that intermediate language is what we're missing. Yeah. All right, so this next one.
What we're talking about there, and that the article you're bringing up now, and between that article and the last article we're jumping off of, also made me question with, because the last article mentioned how many terabytes of data that we're going to start to store for every, for any given type of thing, you know, over time, and this is talking about how much data we're going to be able to store. At what point are the searching algorithms and the speed of ability to process all this data going to be the wall that we can't overcome? We can store a terabyte a second of data, but we don't have the processing power to process it, so we're going to have all this data that's going to be useless because it's overloaded.
I've worked in a situation that was very similar to this. I shouldn't say worked. I was involved with a situation that was very similar to this. CERN.
Yeah.
CERN, yep, they generate a lot of data.
We're going to generate terabytes of data that occurred in less than 1 second.
Yep. I remember that back in the 80s at Princeton in the magnetron.
That's 30, 40 years back. We're way ahead of that kind of storage stuff now. It's
I'm still waiting for
my chance because I've been invited to go there to actually go and walk around CERN.
So there's a good article I didn't bring up this week. It's LinkedIn is running something like 50,000 Hadoop servers. So they can process like 1.5 billion objects a second. And it's all about high-scale computing, to Eric's thing. But that's sort of a drop in the bucket compared to the amount of data you could collect with one of these AI things. They're talking billions. This is what trillions or quadrillions. It's way, way further than that. This is a five-dimensional laser disks. That's right. You can write your laser disk into the future. Yeah, this is really wild. They say that it's possible to have up to 500 terabytes of data. And I know this is the old joke, but I have to say it. Who would ever need 500 terabytes of data on a freaking laser disc? It's like, wow.
I think the self-driving car data collection system.
Oh, my God. Well, to Eric's point, and Eric's making a good point, is an engineering thing here that we just don't have the horsepower to go through the amount of, storage is winning the fight, battle, like from computing to storage. Storage is shooting way, way ahead of what we can do with computing.
Wow. Yeah, I think we're going to hit a roadblock. There's a brick wall of, we got all this data, and you know what? It's kind of useless because we can't reasonably search, parse, process it.
And we're going to end up probably...
And it seems like that brick wall is going to be pretty soon.
I think we're going to end up something like Kubernetes.
You still want to keep it. The whole idea behind keeping it is that we will be able to.
Guys, I think what we're going to end up with is something like Vagrant. We're going to end up with some sort of Kubernetes cloud on the disk itself, where the disk and processing, the data and processing stuff goes together into some sort of little unit of whatever. It'll be a cloud on your computer. Fog. Next article is vertical particles may be real particles out of phase with our reality. You gotta love this. And this guy goes through, explains, he's a physicist, that these virtual particles, which come out of the math that we do with particle physics, actually could be considered particles from another universe that are just out of phase with us. And I had to save this, but it's just too good.
Someone's going to take this and make a movie out of it. This very simple two-sentence statement, and we're going to build a science fiction movie.
And this guy said this is a 5D approach. So we get the 5D disc, and then we get the 5D physics.
I have a family member who is a physicist, and I forwarded this to him.
Yeah.
But I have not heard back from him yet.
Eric, I'm thinking the title would be Virtual Particles from the Fifth Dimension.
Oh, yeah, that group.
Was
that group from Detroit? I forget. The Fifth Dimension?
I think so. Did they do Age of Aquarius?
Maybe. I don't know. I'll go with the...
I should know, but is a little before my time.
Yeah, it's... Yeah.
Neutrino results heralds new chapter in physics. So I give up. I've been talking about this off and on when the stories appear for the last year or so. I give up. There has to be some new figures coming along, because otherwise there wouldn't be this amount of noise. Now, I don't think they have a clue what it is, but they know that they don't know, which is, I think, really cool, actually.
It's half the battle. Yeah. Knowing that you don't know is half the battle.
Well, the physicists seem to be much more honest than some other, you know, academic areas where they're always saying they know stuff. Physicists are like, hey, beats me, you know. And astronomers as well, they see stuff and they're like, I don't know what this is. We're going to have to figure that out. Oh, yeah, this is cool, too. So ultra-high-energy experiments move nuclear fusion closer to reality. So we have talked about electric rockets before, and basically this means heating up some sort of grid or something and making that create the exhaust. The best way to do that is nuclear fusion, and that would be really cool if we could do that. That would, wow, it would probably open up the inner solar system to us.
There's a lot of questions that came to me, and I'm pretty sure that's the article that talked about the different groups that were given the grants. Yes. to okay, and it's like the one that they focused on here, and the guy they interviewed, I think it was a $143,000 grant that they got. And he makes the point that it wasn't mainly about building something. The main goal was the software that let us either model it or test it or to see our results. And I'm thinking $143 doesn't pay one senior engineer's salary. So you've got a bunch of students and people who didn't, you know, who aren't software engineers building this software, which is the key component of this entire thing. How is that the bottleneck? Is that, you know, your software is actually shoddy because of who's building it? And even though you think this is the output of this whole process and this grant that you got, is it really a quality software product that's giving you what you want? Or could you do with bringing in, you know, spending 10 times as much and bringing in a team of software developers and end up advancing the science of what you're trying to do because the software is being written by people who should be writing the software?
I have hung out on Hacker News in various places where PhD students, other academics go on, and every time they talk about their code, they're like, oh my God, it's a total mess of the code, because they're not engineers. They just kind of hack together whatever needs to work.
Yeah, I used to work with a whole bunch of those people. Their code is generally a mess, but the mathematics in it is normally pretty good. So what ends up happening is you get what they've given you, which then you go look at and you start twitching. And then what you do is you start working with them to try to make it into something resembling reasonable code.
Yeah. So then a mixture of bringing the people who know the math in together with the people who know how to write code, and maybe you end up with something that takes them, you know, light years ahead of what they actually ended up with.
Correct. And a normal speed up on models that we were looking at would be something like 100 times.
Nice.
Like
how much does that advance 100
times
doing?
Faster when people that actually knew how to code worked on it.
Yeah.
How much does that improve what they're doing?
Yes, you want the programming to help them explore what they're doing.
Oh, in 10 years, I think we're going to get here. Well, maybe you're going to get there in 10 years because you're going about, you know, developing the infrastructure the wrong way.
Yes.
If your grant is $143,000, I'm not sure how you go about getting the talent that you need to do what needs to be done.
Yeah, I'm going to hope that they actually have multiple grants, and he just mentioned that one, because you can't do much with that kind of money.
Yeah. And I think that you want the program, to Eric's point, you want the programming to facilitate the research, not this bunch of friction where the guy is not a programmer and he's struggling with, you know, error handling or something.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that actually exists in a lot of businesses.
You know,
crappy people writing, you know, you got crappy code coming out, and sometimes, you know, the business person is trying to get their algorithms out there and things like that. You know. So, yeah, it's a problem.
So there was this topic that came up on Twitter, and I was kind of conflicted about whether to bring it up or not, and I think I will. The guy basically said, all of the people who are thought leaders and teach us how to write good code and programming languages and all that are teaching us things that have no resemblance at all to the day-to-day work of the average programmer. And it's so far out that it's like a castle on the hill that it's just not very practical for them at all. And I kind of felt that a little bit, that maybe that's what we are doing. And part of that is we have a lot of bad teams. Yeah, I feel like this guy had a point, that we tend to talk about programming in the abstract, platonic perfection, sense of perfection, when some guys are just struggling to get this dang thing, you know, in production tonight.
You know, working amongst, I've been in mobile for the most part since 2008, but on the mobile side, I've worked on a number of teams, although a lot of the times I've just been solo. But then also seeing some of the other back end people, you know, we're being a part of big teams, even if I only work on, I'm the only one working on this bit of it. The majority of developers I've ever worked with don't know any of the stuff you're talking about. They're not reading books on clean architecture, you know, clean coding. They learn to program either in college or as a hobby. They kind of know what they do. They go off and do it. They work with some other people. They kind of get the feel of what best practices are and in the sphere that they work in. But the stuff, when you say we're teaching, no one's really teaching them. They either learned or they got taught in college, but the higher end stuff you're talking about, certainly there's some people out there. When I was a GM, there was an initiative to, hey, we're going to talk about some of these things. We're going to talk about solid, and we're going to devote a session each week to one of the solid principles. Most of the people had no idea what it was. So I think when you're talking about the world of programmers, for what you're talking about, that's a relatively small subset.
Yes.
I think that's changing a bit today, because the resources required to learn about such things are dramatically dropping.
YouTube gives us the answers to everything.
Well, YouTube is a big part of it, but there's a lot of free or relatively inexpensive content that people can go watch.
So to Eric's point, you're dropped into an environment, and it's not unusual to spend a week just trying to spin up your development environment when you're new to a company, because we make some freaking incredibly Byzantine environments. You're getting all the stuff spun up. You've got maybe a dozen technologies. Maybe you're good at eight, four you don't know. There's just a mix of stuff. You're really going to have a lot of time to go through that entire tech stack to figure out the bells and whistles. Are you just going to figure out, like, what's broken now? Go show me Stack Overflow, plug it in, move to the next thing.
Yeah, there's a certainly a big issue with onboarding. You know, to me, that I learned, you know, one project where the second person I onboarded took days, maybe, I forget. But I was like, all right, that sucked. You know, I should be able to do that better. But, and then there was a constant struggle or a constant goal to cut that in half and cut it in half. And so after a while, like, especially on some newer teams that I helped stand up, we got it down to, yeah, you come on board, you're committing something that first day, even if it's, you know, we only deploy it to QA or something like that. But the idea is that, yeah, you really have to pay attention to that. And as far as all that good free learning, fine, but you got to have either an environment or permission. You know, it's one thing for us to be able to, you know, squirrel away on a weekend or do some nights or, you know, try to do whatever we can. But the company also needs to support learning. You know, that needs to be a learning environment. The company needs to, you know, not just keep whipping the ponies harder, but, you know, encourage learning and encourage, you know, like you were saying, GM was trying to do solid classes and things like that.
Taking Vagrant as an example. Vagrant is a thing you run on your old PC that you can actually spin up pods for Kubernetes. So it's just like a cloud on your machine. You know, it wouldn't be unusual to just be given like a configuration. So, okay, here's the five or six servers you're going to be coding on. It just works. And
yeah, that's That's the goal. I mean, that's the ultimate, is be able to, yeah, you know, here's the containers. You unwrap these. You get all the things you need. Your environment is just like everybody else's environment.
It's great if you never have to dive down. The thing is that once you start diving down, it's not just you can't find the little lever to pull. You don't even know what the machine does.
Right.
Yeah. See, there's a couple more things to when you talk about onboarding and you talk about the ability to encourage learning, yeah. But one point that comes to mind for me is what are you learning? Me personally, almost everything I read is a programming book. It's about learning something new. The last thing I read was Kotlin programming for Android, because I've been, you know, that Google's moving that direction. I've been doing Java Android programming. Okay, I'm going to learn Kotlin. I'm not taking my time to read Code Complete. I'm taking my time to read what Swift UI for iOS development, the new technologies. So, you know, with a limited amount of time, I'm not going back and what can I do to make myself a better, yes, more quality. A friend of ours used the term craftsman, I believe. Yeah, what am I doing to make myself a craftsman versus what am I doing to learn the new stuff that I'm going to need to know that I want to know that I think is cool? I think that happens more frequently. And then the second thing is craftsmen versus, and I used to work under a director of development who referred to us as code slingers. We just love coming in and banging out code.
Yeah, code
slingers. And that's why I started. I'm an indie dev. A lot of my spare time is spent doing indie dev outside of the stuff I work on. I took a job in a startup because I like being a code slinger. And in a startup, you can sling code. Yeah. It is going to be difficult to drag me into, Eric, we're gonna make you a craftsman. No, you're really not. I'm gonna go down a path that allows me to continue being a code slinger.
It's fun.
I think that's a whole lot of people in the field.
It's funny
to add one thing. Okay. I tend not to read things that are about how to do something. I tend to read things that are about ideas.
I wanted to ping off what Eric said. I'm one of these guys that teaches TDD and solid and craftsmanship and all that. However, I'll hack the shit out of some code if we're like up against the deadline or something. I have no problem with that at all. I don't mind being crappy and bad if I know I'm being crappy and bad. I think what bothers me when I see people do that don't realize what they're doing, it's like, no, that's not the way to live. That's just, you know, you can speed like that one time you're late to work, but you can't speed every day. You don't get away with it every day.
I was just going to say, you mean I can't just always code from, you know, copying something from Stack Overflow? And
there's many jobs you can do that.
Oh, I saw this thing. This guy was demoing something off .NET, and he was like, oh, this is really cool. You type in these three things, and off comes out, like, just 50 lines of boilerplate code. I'm thinking, why do programmers, like, desperately need some new way to quickly type in hunks of code they're going to have to go back and figure out later on? I mean, is this, like, something that we've really, I mean, I hit two keys and 1,000 lines come out. Isn't that great? It's like, no, that's awful.
If you design those 1,000 lines and it's part of some sort of a template that you couldn't figure out any other way to build it, so you have to repeat the code.
Oh, right? You know that's going to, yeah, they're going to do a real good job. It's going to be rock solid. Yeah.
I'm sure they're following model-driven architecture and they've got a meta model and a meta-meta model.
Yeah, the meta model is Stack Overflow, copy, paste. The next story is, I think this is like, we've come so far just to come back home. How we rolled out security keys at Twitter, and I gotta admit, I scanned this. I didn't get all the way through it, but he basically said that because of security concerns, they had to go back to physical, you know, like YubiKeys to let people get their stuff. And I'm like, you know, that's probably not a bad idea. This may be where we're all headed in time. Do you guys have much experience using the YubiKeys or the 2FA stuff?
I didn't. Hewlett Packard, I think it was. I mean, it wasn't cumbersome. It wasn't problematic. That's fine.
Yeah, I've got four keys myself, and they're not that bad. You just put them in a USB slot or use a Bluetooth, and you're in. It makes sense to me. If you get a job, they give you some keys.
Yeah, I mean, two examples I've had is one organization basically sent, you know, my colleagues that were writing code in their systems, they sent them a laptop, right? And then another one that we're working with, which is worse, is like Cisco, Citrix, some VDI thing that just, I guess it's a, like a virtual desktop. And it's just horrible because everything's locked down. You know, like you can't cut and paste from your own computer to the inside of that. You know, so it's just, if you want to actually slow down how to work, I guess, you know, that's a way to work too. So, but the YubiKey sounds like that might have been a better solution, something that proves, I don't know, but.
Proves you that you're physically at the machine that's accessing the data.
Yeah.
I had this thing when I worked at Charles Schwab, I guess 20 years ago, the first time I worked there, got this little, I forget what they call it. I still have it in my desk drawer. It just displays random numbers. And like every minute, it gives you a new random number. And then when you get to the password, you just type in the number and you're in. It's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, I remember seeing something like that. Yeah, it's basically both sides know the algorithm that's making those numbers tick. Yeah.
So I think this is where we're headed. But I hope, to John's point, it's not going to be, lock down everything, because that sucks. So this kind of made me angry, along with the story I saw this morning that the Royal Marines kicked the shit out of the U.S. Marines at a war exercise. So that made me kind of sad. This is basically the fire that destroyed the ship in San Diego. And reading this account, it's like nobody knew what to do with fire. One guy saw smoke and just kept walking. I mean, once they realized it was a fire, they didn't know how to put it out. It's very, very sad.
It's almost like things you'd expect them to be trained for.
Yeah, if you fly an airplane, first you learn to fly the airplane, and then they talk about going places and other stuff, but you really have to have some kind of basic stuff. I'd want to be able to put a fire out.
Well, I know a good buddy of mine, surface warfare, not a carrier, but, more of the other types of naval ships, and certainly that is a huge part of the training. It's because you're on your own, man, and it's just like it's on Star Trek, right? What's the battle damage and how to plug holes, how to put out fires, how to shut, compartmentalize it and keep it. Yeah, I mean,
there was a similar story. I think it was near China. There was a Navy destroyer a few years back. It actually ran into some shipping container ship. Because, there were people on the bridge, but nobody knew how to steer the ship enough to not run into the other ship.
Didn't I see in the story that part of the issue was that they thought there were monitoring systems in place that would keep any fire from being that big, that you had to worry about to that extent? What I end up thinking is that we are slowly moving towards, if you saw the Disney movie WALL-E, where humanity was just overbloated and laying there because we were trusting everything to do everything for us, and we forgot how to do everything for ourselves. And no one, things fail, we don't know how to adapt.
So one of my hobby horses is the old Star Trek show. And the reason I like it is because they came up with computer interfaces before anybody else did. They just had to make stuff up. And because they had to make stuff up, they didn't have a bunch of baggage to carry into the thing. They just say, okay, how would we do this? How would Sulu control? What would we do? And what they ended up doing was every time a guy did something on the bridge, you could see what the guy was doing. So everybody on the bridge could look at each control, each person, how they were interacting with the system. These glass screen systems, it's just a black box. You got your head stuck down, you may be doing a touch screen. It's not clear to anybody but you whether you know what you're doing, whether you're hitting the right buttons. It's really bad. And the Hacker News, there's a damage control officer for a U.S. nuclear submarine, and he says that this is half the story. It was even worse than they wanted to let go. It was just bad, bad, bad. This next article is simple product management tricks. Another one of these. Wow, very simple. And he goes over impact effort analysis, make yourself a grid, time boxed work if you can't figure out how big something's going to be, just pick a week or two and go work on it, because then you know when you're going to be done, you'll have to scope it down. Good stuff. I write playbooks before automation. This is apple pie, baseball, all stuff we should all be doing, but I like little articles like this. Remind you what you should already know.
I've bookmarked it for the future since I'm, running an offshore very big software development project right now, and that's not really in my wheelhouse. So I'm like, oh, well, maybe I'll need to remember some of these things and come back to them.
I'm putting together, I downloaded a tool called Obsidian, and it's a note-taking tool I think a lot of PhDs use. And so I'm working on my book about product management, and I've got about 500 articles I flagged over the last few years, and I've got to go through and cross-index them. It's a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
You got a lot of data stored. Now, how are you going to process all of that data in any reasonable amount of time?
It's the old Mark One noggin, not working too fast. But I've got to. What is this next one here? This is the Jupiter atmosphere one.
Wi-Fi issues.
Yeah, it can't be because I'm not actually on the Wi-Fi. Hang on. More than one way to skin a cat here. I don't know why people say that. I do not want to skin cats. There we go. All right, just take that, put it in here.
Yeah, the whole Jupiter planet with a giant atmosphere that's really colorful boggles my mind. It's just like, all we have is like clouds and blue and maybe some green.
What's kind of interesting is that they believe that Jupiter-like planets are more common than Earth-like planets.
Well, that's good. So that means there's less aliens making, you know, Machu Picchu and the pyramids.
Or the aliens pretty much. Like these octopus things that float through the gaseous giants, which is... You see the movie Arrival? Had like sort of the elephantine kind of things?
No.
Good movie. So this is another Jupiter story. This is ammonia lightning. And that's just a freaking really cool picture here. And so even though it's like really, really cold on Jupiter, they still have lightning storms.
Is that like above the, like a large cat litter box?
Yeah, if your cat's doing this, you get take him to the doctor right away. It's you're not going to be happy. You're not going to be happy.
No, ammonia sparks. Ew.
Yeah. I love this article. Something keeps exploding in space, and astronomers have no idea what it is. It's like, oh my God, there's explosions in space.
How do they know?
It's true. It is sensationalized, but true.
It is true. But yeah, space is pretty big. It's a lot bigger than you might think.
Yes, sir? Actually, I think what was untrue about it is there's a whole lot of somethings. One something makes it seem like, oh my goodness, there's something special and unique out there. And this mysterious thing is happening. But no, there's actually a lot of those same somethings all over the place.
This is a golden age for astronomy. This is really a golden age. They're just seeing stuff almost every year that they don't know what it is, can't figure it out. This is a great time to be alive, really.
Oh, better time to be alive will be when they actually have some of the answers to that stuff. I feel terrible that all this stuff I see, 200 years from now, they're going to know a lot more about it. And I would be, I wish I'd been around to be around for that discovery.
Yeah, unless the aliens show up and eat us all, in which case I'm okay right now.
We were in a cathedral in Bologna where Cassini, so there's the Grand Meridian, the line and the marble on the floor. And there's a little hole up in the ceiling, and the light would come. That's where they discovered, like, leap year and other things. Hmm. Crazy.
Scientists tracked a mysterious signal in space. It came from Australia. So I guess there are no Australians in space that I know of, but... They had another story earlier this year where they tracked the signal. It turned out to be a microwave in the building next door. So it's not all going to be,
Oh, that's awesome. Or so they told you. That was the official story.
That's what they say, yes.
Take you off the scent of the fact it's really in Area 51 right now.
They're doing. I keep these UFO stories keep popping up about every 3 or 4 months or so. It's just like, really, we're still kind of doing this X-Files thing? I have no idea what it is. I know that there's some sort of physical phenomenon we're obviously seeing, but people want answers for all this.
So why do you think the U.S. has been leaking this stuff out?
That's a good question. If I were a conspiracy theorist, I would say that the technology has, if there is some technology, some phenomenon, has been picked up by some foreign power, and we'd rather have it be in public domain than just two people. But I don't know. I think the big thing here, from a system standpoint, is that I think the reason we didn't report a lot of this stuff is because nobody wanted to hear it, and if they did hear it, nobody knew what to do with it. So the Hassala Silver thing, okay, we don't have a form for silver things. There's nothing. And so a lot of stuff just disappeared. So what do you feel about UAPs, Eric? You follow any of that news? Or
UAPs?
Unidentified aerial phenomena. Yeah, UFOs.
Have not heard that then.
Yeah. Oh, did you see the Navy pilots came out a few months back, and there was a video of them tracking something?
I saw it, and I'll pay a little bit of attention to it, but I don't get all wrapped up in it. I am absolutely an anything is possible person, so there's even the conspiracy theories. Okay, one in a million of them might be true, and this might be the one. Who knows? When we find out, when something happens that is just in all of our faces and it is indisputable, then I'll be concerned about it. Until then, it's just an interesting sideshow.
I read a book of a guy named Nick Pope. James does a series of warships, fighter planes. They have a series of books that catalog all of these, and he wrote this thing on UFOs. And it started off talking about UFOs, and then it kind of slowly went, and then by the end we're like Nazis with anti-gravity devices. It was like, okay, Nazis building anti-gravity devices. I think maybe we've gone a little too far. I need to pull it back a little bit, but it was a fun read.
John, the aliens stepped in, and so Daniel, you were gone for about
30
seconds there. We couldn't hear you. The aliens stepped in because you were saying something very prescient, and they didn't want us to hear it, so they wiped you out.
Nick, it stopped with Nick and restarted with Nazis.
Read a good book by a famous author who wrote serious stuff about chips, and it started with UFOs are weird, which I agree with. And then it ended up slowly kind of drifting into Nazi anti-gravity machines.
Wow.
Which I think at some point we went a little too far with this. Fun book.
I believe in UFOs. I saw a UFO, so I believe in them.
I see them all the time. It
was just a line segment, though. Literally, it was about like at arm's length, it was an inch long line segment that moved in erratic things in the sky. You know, it was back in the late 60s.
A lot of them are Venus. Yeah. Venus and Mercury count for a lot of them.
Except, I mean, these were really radical, fast movements this thing did. So it wasn't a plane. It wasn't like, you know, we used to watch satellites as kids. Yeah, so it wasn't anything following any sort of celestial orbit, you know, any kind of normal Newtonian physics motion.
Have you ever seen a meteorite up close, like coming by? I saw when I was driving my truck one night, and I guess 100, 200 yards off the side of the truck, this meteorite just came in flaming. And it was pretty wild. It's pretty scary.
And then we were on a RV trip across the U.S. 10 years ago. And at some point, I remember seeing, you know, kind of coming a little bit off axis over us, this thing moving like, I don't know, faster than an SR-7. I don't know what it was, some hypersonic thing. It was just like, yeah, what the hell was that? And we were out west. I don't know. It could have been Area 51. Who the hell knows? But, yes, something super fast.
It stands to reason if astronomers are seeing stuff they don't know, and if physicists are seeing stuff they don't know, there's probably stuff we can see, all of us can see, that we don't know what it is. That's just sort of a reasonable assumption.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's unidentified to me.
Yes.
That's all I know.
Yes. And I think it's non-reproducible. That's what everybody gets hung up on. It's like, I saw this really weird-looking thing, and I can't ever show that to you again because I have no control over that. And that causes a lot of problems.
And I can't... was actually talking to somebody about this last night, and I thought I saw it two nights in a row, but I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I wouldn't swear on a Bible or something. I wouldn't bet $100, but that was my recollection. Cause it was when, you know, like I said, it was when I was a kid, like eighth grade or something like that. And it was, yeah. Who knows?
I saw a blimp once. That was pretty cool stuff. I mean, it's something you rarely ever see, and it's a big thing in the sky. This is a MIDI, musical digital interface. It's 37 years old, and they're upgrading it to 2.0, which is blows my mind because this thing has worked fine for 37 years, but now we're going to make it better. Better.
Good luck.
Yeah, first they'll take the jacks away, then you'll have to have an Apple MIDI plug to make it work.
And they'll change it every 2 years.
Yes. You can only play the songs that they like you to play. Yeah.
And Greg just dropped off, but he said before we got on, he was saying, oh, I can't wait till we get to the MIDI article because I actually have a MIDI keyboard right next to me. So we'll just make that plug for on behalf of Greg.
Yes, if Greg were here.
He has a MIDI keyboard somewhere on his floor next to where he was sitting.
So, Eric, the joke is Greg's been on, I don't know, 7-8 times, but there's been probably 4 or 5 times he came on an hour early, texted me and said, hey, where is everybody? And each time I went, Greg, it's an hour from now. And about the 5th or 6th time, today, an hour ago, he's like, hey, where is everybody? I just ignored him. Like, you'll figure it out eventually. It's been like the 7th time.
Well, it sounds like he travels a lot, so time for him is kind of fluid, I think, maybe.
Yeah, but there's this gizmo called Time Zone. And the calendar has a little checkbox for it. And so I'm in Morocco. I'm like, oh, cool. I'm actually, in the hotel room in the evening, and I think I joined Daniel last night. And yes, that's when I first learned about Greg. Greg being perennially off by an hour, which is kind of hilarious.
Well, I told Melissa, I'm like, by the 5th or 6th time, I'm feeling like Charlie Brown with the football. It's like, I'm not going at this anymore. Greg, you come. I'd like to have you, but yeah. He's like, I'm coming this time for sure. Where is everybody?
Yeah.
So see, that could easily be me at another time because I happen to be in one of those rare states that doesn't change time. So
that's right,
in a few days, you're all going to fall back and I'm going to be right. Like, what happened, everybody? What are you all doing?
Yeah.
What time is it now for you, Eric?
So now we're in the same as Pacific. So it's about to be 1 o'clock here. But another week from now, it'll be a little different.
Yeah, it's about 4 here. Yeah, my UK colleagues are now only 4 hours apart for this week because they shifted. We haven't. So right. Yeah, it's right. The same kind of weirdness with you. Yeah. Like, sometimes we're the same, sometimes we're not. Yeah.
Thank goodness we have some, these little devices that sort of figure this stuff out.
Yeah, and China did the right thing. They just said there's only one time zone. Why bother?
I thought right. The Soviet Union did that too. I think like you're 12 time zones away, and it's still the same as the back over here.
Oh, really? I don't know, but because they are like 12 time zones, like they're from Kamchatka to like St. Petersburg, they're ridiculous in Russia, I think.
Yeah. So before we go, have you guys been reading any books, watching any movies? Something that other folks might be interested in picking up.
I've been reading Tame Flow. It's by Steve Tendon. It's kind of cool.
Science fiction?
No, it's actually just a different way to think about Herbie and the goal and the theory of constraints and Kanban and how to think about. It's a technical book about flow, but it's just he talks about it in some cool ways that I like.
The Product Development Flow book is the book I recommend to anybody because to me that's sort of the mathematical basis of most all Agile is the Product Development Flow book. Eric, been reading, watching TV, scary movies, anything like that?
I mentioned most of what I read is programming books. So, I just finished learning Kotlin on Android. Now I'm porting the iOS game I did 3 years ago over to it and finally almost done with that. But as far as more interesting stuff, I've started watching the Apple Plus Series Foundation based on the Asimov books, and not having read the source material, it's just all new and fresh to me. And so I'm watching the people who are familiar with the source material and loved it, who were like, this is nothing like the source material. And I'm like, well, you know, I kind of like it. Now I'll give it a shot. I don't know what they're not doing right, so it doesn't bother me.
Somebody told me that Dune was really good. I haven't seen that yet.
I have not watched it. I like the game. First one. I don't remember ever watching the first Dune. You know,
yeah.
Back in the 80s.
Dune. Yes, it's
Dune. Yeah.
We haven't been doing. We've been watching. We kind of did a scary movie marathon being Halloween, and it was hit and miss. Lock and Key Netflix series was good, and then there were some movies that probably, you know, 50 cents in a bucket of popcorn. It's a movie. So let me do my goodbye things. Hang on a second, guys. There you go. You've wasted yet another hour of your time that you could have been spending, like, learning to be programming in Kotlin. You could have been learning about UFOs. You could have been doing a lot of good things in your life. But no, you're here with us, and we're really happy to have you, and we'll see you on the internet.